Colorado Springs. I've had the opportunity to spend a little time with him, and he sounds like a heck of a speaker, and he's come with high recommendations. So why don't we give him a great big hand. Don, why don't you come on up?
My name is Don C. I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. I guess first I need to say I'm really honored, to be here. I didn't really know that this has been going on for a long time, so I got the dates for the next one, and me and my family will be to the next one. This is really a fantastic event. You know, there's a lot of good energy and vibrations, I think, going here. So I'm glad I'm here. Probably, I guess you all stand by, you know, in AAs, just talk about your experience, strength, and hope, and then that usually does it. So I'll just stick with that. I guess first to talk about a little bit about my drinking. When I was a child, 11 years, I went and I moved from my family, and I went and I lived with my grandfather. And those were real good years. And when I was about 18, I went to him and I told him, to my grandfather, I need to leave. And he and I lived in this old log cabin. It was way on one end of our reservation. And it was a good life. And so I told him I needed to go. And he told me, he said, I knew that day would come when you would. He said, you've always had this curiosity. You know, he says, we used to be hunting, and he'd say, I always had to run to see what was inside the cave, you know, and I also had to run to see what was on the other side of the hill. And knowing what I know now, I should have known I had some alcoholic tendencies, you know. Curiosity sometimes gets us. And so when I left there, I had every intent of leaving there and being successful. And I wasn't so sure what successful was, but I was full of energy, and I was full of curiosity, and I was out to go and see what was there. And some of the things I wanted to see was, one thing is I wanted to taste the ocean water. I mean, I wanted to see, was it really salty, you know, like they said it was. And I also wanted to see a skyscraper. You know, I'd see pictures of them, and I used to wonder, are they really that tall? And that's about where my head was at. And probably the best way I could describe what happened next is maybe to tell a story. And it's not my story, but I think most anything I know of value I've learned from you folks in AA. So this story isn't mine either. But when I heard it, I really related to it. So I've kind of adopted it because it made sense to me. And the story goes that there was this boxing match, and in that arena was a guy in the black trunks, and that guy's name was Alcohol. And then in the white trunks, there was another guy in there, and that was me. And there were a lot of people. The arena was full. And like you do in most of those events, they always say the front row for your family, so they can be up close to watch what's going on. And so everything seemed to be fine. It was supposed to be a fun thing. And so they brought us together, and they gave us a little talk about fighting clean, and we both agreed to do that. And so the bell rang, and we came out, and me and this alcohol, we started fighting clean, and we started having a lot of fun. And it was no big deal. We would come out there and a few punches, but no big deal. But then as the rounds went on, maybe about the fifth round, Alcohol snuck in a lucky punch, and it really stung, and it, you know, it just really hurt. And I looked at him, and he says, "Oh, that was just a lucky punch." And I said, "Yeah, I agree with that. That was just a lucky punch." So we continued to fight, and the bell continued to ring. And as the round started to continue, the alcohol got more lucky punches. And each time the alcohol would throw a punch, he'd tell me, "Hey, that was a lucky punch. You can whip me." And I says, "Yeah, I know that I can." And so a few more rounds later, it really was a boring fight, and so people started to leave the arena. And then the next round, my family come up and they said, "Hey, look, I think you've had enough. I think you better quit." And I looked back at them and I said, "Just one more round. Just one more round. Just wait." So they went and they sit down. So a couple of rounds later, alcohol was taking that lucky punch at will. And each time it would say, "You can whip me." And I said, "I know that I can." So finally my family come up and they said, "Look, Dad, if you don't leave this arena, then we're going to go." And again, I told them, "Just one more round," because I sure it was that round that I could do that. So I stayed another round, and they left like they said that they would. And then in the next round, it got to where alcohol had the ability to punch and knock me on my knees. So I'm on my hands and knees in front of this alcohol, and it's saying, "You can whip me," and I'm saying, "I'm sure that I can." And so a few rounds later, I'm out on my stomach and I'm crawling out looking at alcohol, looking at his tennis shoes, and he's still telling me, "You can whip me," and I'm saying, "I know that I can," until it finally dawned on me what was going on. And so what I decided to do is I decided to crawl out of that arena and leave it. And so I did. And I was out of that arena for a while, and then I got thinking. I got thinking about that alcohol. And I was in better shape than I was in those last rounds. So I decided what I would do is I would go back to that arena and try it again. That's what we call a slip. So I went back into that arena, and alcohol is standing there with his gloves on the ring, on the ropes. And I told him, I says, "I'm back." And he said, "I knew you would be." He says, "Because you know you can whip me." So I went back into that arena, and it wasn't like the first round. The last round was repeated, but it was a little bit worse. So right away, alcohol put me on my stomach, and it didn't wait for me to get up. It started to kick, and it started to do things that wasn't fair, but telling me all the time that I could whip him. And so I crawled out of that arena again. And I did that a number of times, going out, getting in shape, and obsessed with that idea that what he told me was the truth, that this disease that I have, it tells me I don't have a disease, and yet it does those things. So it was in August of 1978, August 9th, that I was able to look at alcohol's tennis shoes and fully concede to my innermost self that I have this disease of alcoholism. And you know, during those times, there was a lot of funny things. You know, I was raised with a good family. I was raised with a good value system, and I was raised with good morals. And during those times of those bouts, I went out and repeatedly did things that I knew I shouldn't be doing. And when the blackout set in, I did many things repeatedly, very sick, very shameful things. And I didn't just do them once, I did them many times. And each time those would happen, it just seemed I was in a downward spiral. Between the summer of 1977, that summer and that fall, I attempted suicide 5 times because I just could not stand to live anymore. Alcohol is a funny thing. It's a slow killer sometimes, you know. And there were a lot of things I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand why one of my sons would come out for the breakfast table and he would climb up on a table and he would sit in front of me on a table and he would put his little hands in my face and he'd say, "Dad, are you coming home tonight?" And I'd look him in the eye and I'd say, "Yes, I'll be home." And I wasn't lying to him. I meant it. Then I meant it. But I couldn't understand why is it I could do that and then go on a spree, you know, that afternoon and go out and do those things. So I didn't understand a lot of those things until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. So I spent about 9 months or so in AA, and I was going to meetings, and I was slipping, but I was going to a lot of meetings. I remember the first AA meeting I run into, I was in treatment. And I'll never forget, there was this young girl that had chaired that meeting, and what she said was, she said, "Today is my 90th continuous day of sobriety." And everybody applauded, you know, and they clapped. And I was sitting in that chair, and there was a guy sitting next to me. His name was Dave. And I was thinking about what she said, and I whispered over to Dave, I said, "You know," I said, "she's lying." I said, "That's from Memorial Day all the way to Labor Day." I said, "There's no way that she can go that long, you know, without drinking." And I think for me, my turning point for me is I don't think it was anything that I did of my own activities that got me into the program, and it got me in this program of sobriety. There used to be this place I would go outside of Colorado Springs, the Garden of Gods. And there was a certain place, or there was a rock. In my own mind, I call it Spirit Rock, and it had a tree. And by then, I was drinking alone for a couple reasons. One is people didn't like to go out drinking with me because I was unpredictable. And the other thing is I didn't like to be with them either. So I used to frequently go out to the Garden of Gods, and I would go to my rock. And I had a 64 Chevy truck. I called that truck Old Blue. And there's me in that truck. And I had an old guitar. I knew 3 chords on that guitar. And I used to go out there with that truck and in my bottle of whiskey and that guitar, and I would go sit up there and I used to sing Hank Williams songs. You know, sometimes when we're drinking and sometimes we get singing, we can think we can sing better than those people can sing, you know. I used to sit out there and I think, you know, if they heard me instead of Hank Williams, you know, I'd have been the one up there singing those songs. But this one particular night, I was going to that place, and it was drizzling just a little bit. And I parked the truck, and I went up there on that rock, and I was pretty drunk. I was climbing up on that rock and with my whiskey and my guitar, and I slipped. And so I lost my whiskey, and it went tumbling down this rock, and my guitar went, and the neck broke. You know, sometimes when it's those things, that's the only friends you have. You know, that guitar was it was a friend, and so was the bottle. See, the bottle was my friend. And I slipped on that rock, and I laid upside with my head down in the dirt, and my feet was up on that rock. And you know, sometimes when we have those bouts with drinking, every once in a while there's a moment. I call them teachable moments, but there's a moment when that moment is worse than any of the other moments. And it was like that. I couldn't, as I was laying there upside down with my face in the dirt, it was the negativeness was amplified by so much I was just sick. And it was there that I just uttered these words. I asked the Creator to help me to live. And I didn't think about that. It came out. Now, I used to talk to him once in a while before about getting me out of this one and I'll never do it again and I really, 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 really mean it and all of those things. But for me, that was a turning point because I had a funny feeling and it was just kind of a feeling. And so in the next 2 weeks, I got in so much trouble. I was in trouble, you know, quite a bit, but I was in trouble every time I turned around. I was in trouble. And I didn't know, you know, till after I got in a program that that was the answer to a prayer that I made. And so it was through that system I got into a treatment center. I was forced into a treatment center. And it was there I run into Alcoholics Anonymous. That first year, 9 months, that I was slipping, there was one thing I wouldn't do is I didn't get a sponsor. And the reason I didn't, I was at a meeting one time and I heard this guy say he was 7 years sober and he never had to get a sponsor. And I said, that's my man. That's the one that I'll relate to. But August 9th, when I went on my last drunk, when I woke up that next morning, I was ready. Before, I wasn't sure I was ready. Sometimes I was 50% sure I was alcoholic, sometimes 100%. It could change to 80. But I never was able to fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. So when I came into that program, that last time, there was one thing I was willing to do, and that was I was willing to get a sponsor. And I'd been watching this guy. So I went up to him and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he told me that he had been watching me for a while. And he said, one of the things I'll need to do, he says, we're going to need to talk about sponsorship for a little bit. And so we sat down at the table with a cup of coffee. And one of the things he told me, he says, the only program I know how to work is by this big book. And he opened up 164 pages, and he said, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the instructions for the steps are in his first 164 pages. And he said, what you're going to do is you're actually going to bet your life that if you do what it says in those pages, that you will be able to stop this, what you're doing. And he told me, he said, what this program is about, never drinking again, never needing to do that. And you know, I had read that big book before, and I used to hear people talk about working steps. You know, when you don't know what that is, think about when you come in, people say, I want you to work these steps. That doesn't make any sense. And I used to try to watch, where do people go to do this thing, to work these steps? I didn't understand what those words meant. And they told me that inside that big book was instructions, you know, and I used to look through that thing looking for those instructions. To me, that big book was the most boring book I think I ever read in my life as far as trying to figure out, see what was in it. And that man, he told me, he said, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they give you two things. He says, one thing, they give you a spiritual direction in every area of your life. He said, the next thing that the steps allow you to do is to hook into power. And he told me that each one of those steps had power. Step one would give you the power to go to two. Two would give you the power to go to three. And then he sent me home, and I was to look at that page in the big book that had those 12 steps on, and I was to ask two questions with each of those 12 steps. The first question I was to ask with each step was, do I want to do this step? He said, don't worry about how. But what you're to ask yourself is, do you want to do it? He says, because the funny thing about alkies, you know, you don't have to do anything. And we're pretty good at that. When somebody tells us we have to do something, the way I was. If somebody says you have to go south, I'd go north. If they told me to sit down, I'd stand up. If they told me don't try it, I would try it. I had this, just the feeling would come inside. I thought something was wrong with me. I didn't know until later on he was setting me up with those two questions. Did I want to do it? And the second question I was to ask with each step was, am I willing to go to any length to do that step? And he said, now let me give you a picture of what willing to go to any length means. He said, if I were to set in front of you a small glass of beer on the left, and on the right I would set a plate with 17 pounds of warm dog poop, you would eat the dog poop instead of taking the beer. He says, that's what it means, am I willing to go to any length? So I went home, and I went through those instructions that he gave me. And what I did is I come back and I told him I wanted to do the steps, and I told him I was willing to go to any length. But what I really said inside of myself is I'm going to commit to go through the fifth step, in that if I'm not able to myself notice the difference, then I wasn't going to do no more. But I would commit to those five. So I went over to his house, and he showed me that the instructions for the first half of the step was in the first 43 pages of the big book. And as he started to help me to read and to see what was it I was to look at, then I started to see some things. I started to understand that that book was written by people who have the same disease that I have. I think if a normal person reads that book, it's just kind of a nice reading book. But if a person like myself reads that book, it's written in a manner of people who have this disease that got into recovery. I started to understand some things in that book. And just little things as I started to understand when it says, there'll come a day when you have no mental defense against that first drink. In other words, I always thought that I could think something that would guarantee me when that time come that I couldn't drink. So now I started to understand why it was I could drive right to the bar and tell myself I wasn't going there, or I was going there for something else, and consistently I did that to go get drunk. I started to understand why my son could sit on the table and I could commit and tell him and I would end up going on another spree. I started to see, I thought it was to do with willpower, and I started to see it had nothing to do with willpower. So I was able to come to terms with, by those first 43 pages, what it was I was to look at, what it was I was to admit powerlessness over alcohol. Then I went back to him, and on page 52 in the big book, he showed me that there's 9 areas to look at as far as unmanageability is concerned. I was to take a look at my personal relationships, and I was to take a look at my emotional nature, and I was to take a look at making a living in my life full of fear. And with his help, I got through the second half of that first step. And I didn't really notice something going on. I was just doing it. I mean, I had all these questions and that stuff, but I consistently went ahead and just did that. And when I got to the second step, he showed me that the chapter 2, agnostics, had the things I needed to know for that second step. Now, I had some problems when I came in with the concept of God. And I think one of the most powerful things for me when I first came in was that little phrase, it was God as we understood him. That thing was very important to me that it was in there. And with the help of that sponsor, I was able to see that in my mind there were some things that had a problem to do when I said the word God. I didn't know that, but he knew that. So one of the things he allowed me to do, or he suggested that I do, is just give this power a nickname. And then he told me about the second step, about came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could. He talked to me some about willingness. See, I thought willingness was something I had together, maybe 5 pounds of it, then that would be enough. So I thought that was in quantity. And what he explained to me is willingness. He says, if you are remotely willing to kind of maybe possibly think, that there might be a million divided by 10, a possibility of a power, way more than enough. He said, it's way more than enough. So as I read that chapter to Agnostic, and he had me read that many times, and one of the things he had me also do, he says, there's some questions in that chapter, and they need to be answered. And one of them I was to take a look at is either God is or he isn't. And he said, I want you to look just as strongly at God isn't. And so me and my arrogance, I went out and I says, boy, that's good. So I started to look at that one first. I thought, I'm going to go and try to prove that there isn't this power. And as I started to do that, I started to spend some time outside and in the park and a little bit in the mountains. And all of a sudden I started to ask myself some questions. I started to ask myself, how does that bird stay alive? It doesn't have no batteries. Everything that has power seems to have batteries. Then I started to look at the trees, and I'd say myself, how does my heart keep beating? What is it makes it do that? And so the more I tried to prove that there wasn't this power, the more I came to terms with that there was something. And then I read towards the end of that chapter to Agnostics. It was the first time I noticed that there's certain things in the big book is in this italics, I think is the word. And I saw that one thing in italics, and it says in there, who are you to say? And I didn't ever see that before, even though I had read that many times. Who are you to say? And so it was through that that I was able to come to terms with that there was this power. So I gave this power a nickname, and I nicknamed this power Charlie. And the reason I did that was, I had this friend one time when I first left the reservation. I went to college, and I really liked this guy. He was the kind of a friend. He never judged me, never did anything. We were true friends, and his name was Charlie. So I just thought that I would name that power that. And so then I went on to the third step, and that sponsor, he showed me in the big book where all the instructions were for that step. And that part, being convinced we were at step three. And one of the things he had me consider, that each one of those lines in that book, it was an instruction. So it says, when we need to be convinced that our life is run on self, well, I needed to say, is that thing talking about me? Not, oh yeah, that's a neat thing. But each one of them, I needed to say, is this instruction applying to me, looking at my experiences? So as I got through that, I started to see some things like about the actor, and about trying to control things, and about running things. And I started to see a whole lot of things. I couldn't deny within myself that that book was written about me. That's the way I was trying to run things. And I had quite a fear on making that decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of this power. And once again, it was in an AA meeting. I heard this story. Sometimes stories is very powerful for me. I seem to understand stories better. But there was a guy in that meeting, and it was on the third step meeting, and he and I got together, and he told me this story about these frogs. Some of you may have heard it, but I'll just tell it again because it's my experience. But he said to me, he said there were four frogs sitting on a log. And he said, one of those frogs made a decision to jump in the water. How many frogs are left on the log? And I looked at him, I said, well, there's three. He said, no. He said, there's still four. He said, one of those frogs just decided to jump, but he didn't. And he said, what happens in the third step, when you make that decision, he says, like that frog makes a decision to jump in the water, then what God does makes that frog orange. So he just goes, and he makes that frog orange sitting on the log who just made that decision with three other green frogs. And then in my mind, I started to understand some things about that third step. So one of the things I came to terms with is that in making that decision, that wasn't a decision that I would turn over and take it back. In other words, I wouldn't go orange, green, orange, green. Now, once I made that decision, I was an orange frog. So if I got angry or upset the day after, what I was an angry, upset orange frog. So I came to terms, you see, with that third step. So I went over to my sponsor's place and I told him I was ready to take that third step. So me and this man, we got down on our hands and knees in his living room, and we each had our big book and opened it up to that third step prayer. And we hung on hands, and then he read the third step prayer, and then he told me to do the same thing. Then I read that third step prayer. And it was right after that third step prayer was the second time I had that funny feeling, that same one that I experienced in the Garden of Gods. And I could kind of tell, I can't describe that feeling, you just kind of feel this thing. And there was another thing happened there. He had a cat, and me and cats don't get along. We get along good because they know not to come around. You know, cats are very knowledgeable about things. So anyway, this cat jumped down, and it came, jumped up on my lap, and it started to just rub its body, you know, on my body. So that was very unusual for a cat to do. So I asked my sponsor, I said, well, what do we do next? And he reached behind his chair, and he pulled out a tablet of paper and a ruler and a big book. And he says, in the big book, it says, next we launched on the course of vigorous action. And so I was writing inventory before I left his house. And he showed me how to write inventory on resentments. And he showed me where the instructions were in the big book. And I wrote inventory on resentment, fear, and on sex. In my first experience with the inventory, he gave me a prayer to write on top. And he said, on each page, write this prayer. God, help me to be honest. So I wrote, Charlie, help me be honest. Help me to remember and give me courage to do inventory. So I went and I started, I went home and I kind of didn't put a lot of strong emphasis on that prayer. So I wrote, to help me to remember and to help me be honest. And I didn't write the line, give me courage to do inventory. As I started to write the inventory, what I prayed for, I got. But one of the things happened was there was something I'd stuffed in my mind from a long, long time ago. And what happened there when I was very young, maybe 9 years old, I was sexually molested, and I didn't think I had it stored in there. And that came back up, and I started to remember that. And I got so sick, I didn't know that the inventory, you know, would do that. So I got very sick. I vomited and I got angry and I tore up my inventory and I tore up that big book and I just kind of went crazy. So I went over to my sponsor's place and he asked me exactly what did I do, and I told him. I said, I wrote that prayer and I started writing. And, you know, good sponsors, they don't listen to you. They ask you again, what exactly did you do? And I found out that I left out that line in that prayer to give me courage to do inventory. So then when he found out I had tore up my inventory, he laughed like hell. And I spent the weekend over there getting in a groove again and writing the inventory. And so I wrote out those things, like I said, all the dark crannies. Everything needed to be told. And when I was done with my inventory, I knew it was good. I knew I didn't leave anything out. The only thing that I did is I had 25 dark crannies I wasn't so sure I was going to tell anybody. And I put the dark crannies on a special page. You know, I didn't mind telling people I cheated on my wife and I committed adultery and I did all these things. They all knew it anyway. So it wasn't like that was the worst part. The worst part of the inventory was my dark crannies. So this particular night came and I was waiting for the right time, the fifth step. And what happened was I didn't want to do it, but I knew it was done. And so this particular night, that feeling set in, that feeling of like that compulsion to drink. And I knew that night I either needed to do a fifth step or drink, and that was the only choices that I had. So I called up my sponsor, and what happened is they had just taken him to the hospital. So I called up another guy. that I knew. And he didn't answer his phone. So I called another guy, and I didn't know him very well, but I respected him. And you know, when you're first in, it's really hard to call up like a stranger and say, hey, can I fifth step? I mean, it's very difficult to do. So I called him up, he answered the phone, and so I was kind of stuttering, but he also was smart enough to know that there was something that was going on. So he asked me a couple questions. He asked me what step I was on. And I had to say five because I just finished four. And so he figured out what I needed to do was to do a fifth step. And so I went over to his place. We had coffee. And I went through my inventory. But one thing I didn't do was I didn't tell him my dark crannies. And I think he in his wisdom, like AA people, you know things. He knew that there was probably something else. And he asked me if I had more to do. And I was trying to think up a good answer. And when I was trying to think up a good answer, he says, let me share something with you. And so he shared some of his own experiences. And what he shared with me was some, what I would call some dark crannies. And I can remember when he got into about the third one, they were as sick as mine. I can remember, see, I had a fear of what if they tell somebody? I mean, a lot of them were sexual and they were sick things and I had stolen money and some of them involved things in the law. I thought, what if he tells? And so I can remember about the third little event he told me about, I can remember thinking, you know, to myself, and it was almost like a relief. I could remember thinking, you know, okay, son of a bitch, you tell on me, I'll tell on you, you know. And it was like a relief, but I didn't know, see, that the program had made him free of those things. But again, he was very, very smart. So I went ahead and I shared those dark crannies. And then he showed me the instructions in the big book that I was to go home, and it says in there to claim to thank God from the bottom of your heart that you know him better. And so I went home and I got on my knees and I was kind of talking to Charlie, you know. And I built a pretty good relationship. And during that conversation with him, I found that I had switched from using the word Charlie and I was using the word God. And probably for me the most phenomenal thing in the fifth step was that freedom from the guilt. I didn't know that that would happen. I didn't know that what that meant was is that I would remember the words, I would remember the pictures, but that paralyzing guilt and that shame and all those things, it was gone from my head, that it went away. So I went ahead because I could tell because of how I felt. I could tell something was going on. In fact, that was the first time, was after my fifth step, that I said to myself, you know something, this program is going to work. See, I wasn't used to being the one who something worked for. I had this saying, if it wasn't for bad luck, I've had no luck at all. I was always like second in line, always in the wrong line, but being a friend of somebody who something worked, but I didn't ever have something work for me. So I went on to do step six, and I went on to do step seven. And then I come to my amends. I got a lot of experience with amends. My first time I did the amends, I made my amends in categories. I made the easy amends, the medium amends, and the hard amends. And so I went and made a couple easy amends, and I thought, this is really good. So I went and I took the third easy amend, and I had that amend blue. I went there to make this amend to someone, and they turned around and told me some other stuff that I had done, and I wasn't sure I'd done it, but I was kind of sure I did, and they kept getting emotional, and then I started attacking them back, and they started saying some stuff, and then I jumped on them, you know, for here I am trying to make, and that thing took place. So I ended up making an amend for making an amend, and those are humbling. So I found what I was doing, I was making amends on self-confidence. I made two, I thought I knew enough. So I got me some help on amends, and I found that I really make amends. See, I make amends to set myself right with God. That's why I make amends. And then I went on, and it took a while for me to get a handle on step 10 and 11. Even though I came out of the amends, I was still emotional. I was moody. A lot of those things were still going on. So it wasn't that I got into step 10 and 11. And I took it precisely out of the big book that I started to see some balance and some things in my life. When I come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been kicked out, and I was given that one chance, and I went out and I drank again, and I left. And I left here with that old truck, old blue, and I was given one fork, one knife, one spoon, one towel, one... It was just all fit in one box. I went up to Denver, and I got this little apartment. I didn't have much money. I was really financially bankrupt in some of those things that happened to us. In this apartment I stayed, it was like a little smell like a swamp in here. It was cheap. I used to think, geez, if I could just get this stuff straightened out to program, it would be easy to work. I wanted some material things. And I'm really glad that they didn't come. At first I thought that would make it easier, but really in the big book it says spiritual first, material second, that it's never the other way around. That was a blessing. The first year of my sobriety, I wasn't allowed to see my children. I had three children. Now I would go to the second year. In the second year I would go there, and they would kind of stick around, hi Dad, and then they would leave. The third year of my sobriety, just a couple of days before Christmas, this is the first time they got in the car with me. I took them Christmas shopping. And I came back, and as we walked up to the steps, first my oldest son, he turned around and he put his arms around me and he said, Dad, I love you. And then the second one did. And my daughter did. And that healing took 3 years to do. My first wife and I had done a lot of damage there. So we weren't able to, we weren't one of those in that situation, we were able to build it back. Then later on, I remarried. And the woman I married, she had a daughter, her name is Angela. And so I adopted her. And then Joan and I had two more children, Morningstar and Kateri. And, you know, this program, when I came in, I said to myself, if I can just not drink, I just wanted to be sober. I didn't have any idea that it offered a quality of life was beyond a drunk's understanding. I didn't know about all these other things. So there's one thing my sponsor told me. He said, Don, he said, what this program is about, it's about changing. He says, if you think you can keep doing what you're doing and thinking what you're thinking and acting like you're acting, you've got to change. And that the steps is 12 gentle ways, if you do what it says in that order, to put that spiritual direction, you know, in my life. And I didn't really think it would happen. I didn't think it would happen the way that it has. So I'm friends with all my children. My first three children, I used to be, if you look at it in today's terms, I was a child beater. I did some things to those kids. I didn't know sometimes I did them, but I'm sure I did. The welts were there the next day. And all of those things changed. You know, that got healed, and some of it's still healing. Now, these three children I have now, I rarely raise my voice to them. I don't need to do that anymore. I haven't spanked them. I don't need to spank them anymore. There's another whole way, see, of doing those things.
I've been in a program, I was promoted 5 times. I still got old blue, I got a new engine in it, painted it from blue to white. I still got that truck, I got a different guitar. I still got that old one, and I keep it there for me to remember. I didn't get it fixed. I'm a pretty good father today. I ain't got a house. So all those things, they turned around, you know, thanks to this program. I think when I was drinking, the worst thing, if I were to pick, of all the stuff that happened, if I were to pick one thing that was the worst, it would have been the loneliness. That hole that you get inside and you can't fill that thing no matter what you do. And I went and tried a lot of things to just fill that hole, even for 2 minutes. I'd done anything. If I look at the best thing that's in my sobriety, if I pick the best, and I talk about that job and that stuff, because that's part of my story too. But if I pick the best thing, it's the relationship I have with my Great Spirit. To AA, in getting clear, I went back and I returned to my culture. So I used to think culture was foolish. I thought that was something for the old people. But I found out what goes on in the culture and in AA is the same thing. These are not different things. It's about all of us walking on this path that the Creator would have us to walk. It's about living a life of choices. I thought before, if I come into AA, there'd be a lot of rules. I was living with rules before. But so I found out about choices. The relationship I have with the Creator is very practical and very common sense. And that is the best things of all. I've learned to live life on His terms, and I've had ups and downs and all that stuff that happens to us. But to have these tools are incredible. You know, each year I go through the steps. I just do that because I was sponsored that way. I'm going through them right now, discovering those obstacles and those blocks. You know, sometimes I think it won't work again. When I start to find this stuff, I say that again. I bet it won't work. But it does. I know that it does. It goes on and helps you to see. I guess the reason I go through the steps each year, because it always seems that my ego works on where I have my shit together. Right where I think I'm strong, when I do in that inventory, there it shows me that I got that ego mask and those things again. So sometimes when I'm in a meeting and they read those steps, I feel like standing up out of respect. You know? I think that the Creator saw that we weren't making it and we were all dying. And I think he said, I got to make some instructions. It's really simple for these guys. And I'll give them a book. And it's not a thick book. And I find that's my experience with that. Those steps is probably the most impactful thing that I know. I think the other thing that is impactful is you that are in here. You are my teachers. You tell me a lot of things, save me a lot of time. Even sharing things that you do that don't work, that is of value to me. Because then I can choose to not do them. So, how I feel about AA is, I always felt like a stranger. I even sometimes felt like a stranger, even in my own tribe. I never felt a part of that thing that makes you feel apart. See, like coming here today, you know, you are my people. I feel more comfortable here than I do there. See, you made me welcome here. You keep coming back and not bossing me around and let me grow how I need to grow. You had the wisdom to do that. So to me, I love this program. I love you people. I owe you my life. I still do some things on a regular basis. I attend meetings regularly. And I still read the big book regularly. Just like when I came in, you showed me how to do that. And I still pray in the morning for another day of sobriety, and I thank the Creator for that at night. So that's kind of my story so far. So what I'd like to do is maybe close this with a prayer. I'll read this prayer and then I'll close. So this prayer goes like this. This is, O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds and whose breath gives life to all the world. Hear me, I am small and weak. I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty and make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things you have made and my ears sharp to hear your voice. Make me wise so that I may understand the things you have taught my people. Let me learn the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. I seek strength not to be greater than my brother, but to fight my greatest enemy myself. Make me always ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes, so when life fades, as the fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame. Thank you very much.